Hello, friends. Today is episode 2 of my mini-series on poverty in the United States. I sit down and talk to a police officer who patrols an inner city in the United States to show the linkage between poverty and crime. I've kept their identity hidden. I hope you enjoy this podcast. Welcome to Open Minds. It's the podcast that attempts to explore with genuine curiosity the world's most intriguing issues. Some topics include climate change, gun control, basic income, and so much more. I invite guests on who are both proponents and detractors of these issues so that we can be exposed to more nuanced perspectives we may not be hearing. You can find me at openmindspodcast.com or anywhere you stream music. I'm your host, Christopher Balkrin, and welcome to Open Minds. You know, when you look at poverty and crime, there's just endless research on this topic, from education and housing to family supports to adult supervision. The list goes on. But I wanted to learn from a police officer firsthand who experiences this on a day-to-day basis to get their perspectives. You know, what are some of the unique challenges that youth in particular are facing, and what can the police do? I think a lot of us know the linkages between poverty and crime, or at least we understand or surmise what they are. But talking to a police officer who lives this day in and day out, they offer a very unique insight into the lives of youth and also their surroundings and what they see. What's interesting here is that while some youth have a mistrust of adults, there is this idolization sometimes of older youth in their communities that engage in criminal behavior. I wanted to unpack that and understand why that might be. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. I've kept this police officer's name hidden because, you know, I do respect their privacy, and I do respect the fact that they've chosen to come on the podcast and share their perspectives. This podcast will be available on my website, openmindspodcast.com. Definitely, if you haven't, follow me on Instagram at Open Minds Pod or on TikTok at Open Minds Podcast. I hope you enjoy this one, and I'll catch you in the next one. I wanted to pivot to crime. Phil, I've seen so many stats about low-income families in crime. Just the overall nature of non-fatal violence is much higher in poor communities than it is in middle-income and high-income communities. I wanted to get your sense first, just the nature of the types of crime that are happening in poor communities.
So I work in the urban community of where we live, which is extremely poor, specifically the district that I'm part of. We see all types of crime. So violent crime, which would obviously the highest one would be murder. And then your petty crime, which would be a group of people hanging out on the corner. So everything in between, that's what we see. So we deal with all of that.
In terms of how this differs from middle-income and high-income communities, what are the types of crime that you see in poor communities that are more prevalent?
I would say the most prevalent crime in the community I work in would be domestic violence. Second, I would say aggravated assault by firearm, you know, shots fired, and then obviously homicide. That would be the top three.
What do you think are some of the underlying reasons for domestic violence in particular?
So to dive into domestic violence, we have to go extremely deep. I'm not sure how much time we have, but I'll try my best to cover all of it so it's not too drawn out. So with domestic violence, it starts with obviously a couple, or what the state kind of puts in as what is domestic violence or what is a domestic partnership, right? A domestic partnership can be labeled as boyfriend, girlfriend, boyfriend, boyfriend, girlfriend, girlfriend, anybody who's relating into a dating relationship, father, son, parents and their children, but the children have to be over the age of 18. And roommates. Roommates are considered part of the domestic situation. I would say that they're engaging in domestic violence because there's just so much going on. Like, there's just, people are arguing about everything these days, especially what I've seen. Especially when we go there, it's kind of just like, okay, well, what happened? Mm-hmm. Well, the argument started because his phone or her phone. It's always the phone situation. Where it's he's not paying his half of the rent, or I'm sick of him bringing people over. And the parent situation, the child thinks that they could do whatever they want, but it's an adult child. And as long as they're living in my house. So there's like zero lack of communication. So that's why we see a lot of domestic violence.
I was reading that when it comes to domestic violence, there's so many other like confounding variables, like access to safe housing. There's cars and weapons that men typically use against women in domestic violence, not necessarily as an act of violence, but as a threat of violence. Like, you see that gun, I'm going to shoot you with it. You see that car, I'm going to run you over with it. Do you see the same types of kind of confounding variables like that are more prevalent in poor communities? Because I can imagine for middle class and high income communities, yes, there's domestic violence, of course, but it's not nearly the same level. And maybe some are wondering, what makes it so unique in poor communities that it's so much more higher?
Right. So in poor communities, we have to start from the beginning, like I said before. So a lot of children, right? So we'll start from the kid. Let's just take one random kid, right? He comes from a broken home, which is, you know, prevalent in these communities. He goes to school. He's already initiated into the gang life. Like, he sees what's going on, right? Mm-hmm. He doesn't have the means of getting proper footwear, proper clothes, as far as what these other kids are wearing. So he now wants to figure out how to acquire these things. So hence introduced to the gang life, right? In the gang life now, they're, in order to make money, you're selling drugs, selling guns, doing stealing cars, doing all these types of crimes in order to get money. Now they're getting money. Now they have access to firearms, things of that nature. Now they get into relationships, right? So what you're originally talking about, the charge would be terroristic threats, where it's like, hey, you see this gun? I'm going to shoot you and kill you with it if you don't do whatever, right? So they do have access to that. And that's kind of how that comes into play with domestic violence of crime, terroristic threats.
You mentioned aggravated assault. For those that don't know what aggravated assault is, can you give like just a high level definition of what it is?
Yeah, so you have simple assault, which is anything that says ow. Which basically, if I punch you in the face and it hurts, that's simple assault, right? Okay. But if I punch you in the face and now you have a black eye and your eye is shut, it's aggravated because you lose the sense of seeing. So if you lose any of your five senses, and you like break bones, that's considered aggravated assault. If you use a weapon, that's considered aggravated assault.
Okay. And do you think, okay, so help me understand, for poor communities, what are some of the reasons and rationale for the assault? Is it over money? Is it job insecurity? Is it just nothing to do kind of thing? There's lack of opportunity in the communities. What are some of the underlying reasons why people commit these types of crime?
I think the biggest, I mean, all those are valid reasons, but I think that the biggest one is because they don't know, or people in the community don't know, with poverty, don't know how to channel their anger. That's very big because, you know, we're seeing in schools that the dropout rate is insane. And they cut a lot of the after school programs with budget cuts and stuff like that. So there is no way to kind of channel their anger, like a gym. And a gym membership costs money that they don't necessarily have, or boxing that they don't necessarily have the money to do. So again, they look for a sense of family and they look for a sense of belonging. So they get into the gang life, right? And I know what I'm saying sounds kind of cliche.
No.
But it is true, like when you start to see it in real life, that they are hanging out with a whole bunch of people on the corner and they're all gang members. In order to be a part of that gang, in order to be down or in order to have a sense of belonging, you must commit these violent acts. And these violent acts translate when it comes to domestic violence because it's all they know, right? Like, it's kind of just like, all right, if I know that I'm going to get my way, if I beat somebody up, then that must hold true in my relationship, whatever relationship that may be, whether it be with a roommate, boyfriend, girlfriend, or my parents. It'll just hold true because that's what they know.
Yeah. Have you seen someone get into that gang life that normally, if, you know, that's not quote unquote who they are, but the gang life influenced them to that level, and there's still that hesitation, you know, it's like they're still struggling with that, you know, the good or the bad, and they still go down that path. And sometimes you just want to tell them, like, you were on the right path, and you were just surrounded by the wrong people. I'm assuming you see that a lot, eh?
Yeah, that happens all the time. One of my good friends on the job, he's a coach for the football team. And a lot of these, it's crazy though, a lot of these kids, they have so much pressure at the age of 15, 14 from their families where it's like, hey, you have to make it. Mm-hmm. You have to, like, never drop that pass. You can't miss a tackle. Mm-hmm. You can't be tackled. You have to make every single touchdown. You have to win. And when the kid doesn't, they become a write-off to the family, right? Because the family looks at as that person or that specific kid getting them out of their situation, you know, which is going into the NFL, NBA, MLB, like whatever the case may be. So when they do fail, it's kind of just like, all right, well, I fail. So my next option is gang life, drug life, gun life. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's extremely unfortunate, but it's kind of just like, okay, if it's not football and it's not sports, then it has to be gangs. Mm-hmm. It's either or. There's no like in between.
You know, what's interesting is that I feel like when it comes to parental or adult involvement in low-income communities, specifically with youth, there's this mistrust, distrust of adults in general. Maybe it's because of their own upbringing. Maybe it's because they might have been abused by their parents or guardians, and there's already this distrust. When it comes to community workers, teachers, etc., there's just this, you know, I'm not really going to pay attention to them. But when it comes to the police and law enforcement, there's almost this like hatred or this like war. And why do you think that is? I mean, well, I'm sure there's obviously, we all know.
Different reasons, but the most is, I'll give you a couple of reasons, and then I'll get into like a story or whatever. Again, with the going back to domestic violence, that's any patrol cop. That's that, you know, they answer calls, 911 calls. The guys on patrol, just to be clear, are not the guys that are like doing big drug investigations or looking for guns. They're literally answering 911 calls because the volume is so high, right? So, which makes sense as to where their arrest would be coming from. Domestic violence, because New Jersey, the level of domestic violence, how seriously they take it is crazy. So it's a mandatory arrest. With that being said, you know, you respond and there's probably, you know, more than likely there's a kid there, right? And it's a minor and they're probably going to be 4 or 5, any age, and you're arresting daddy and mommy in front of them, right?
Right.
And as much as we try to tell them, you know, put the kid away, but it's such a chaotic scene that, like, people's safety are involved, the officer's safety, the safety of the victim. You know, people are normally intoxicated because, again, I work on the night tour. So this is, again, my perspective, right? Mm-hmm. So you're locking these people up in front of their kids. So automatically it's like, oh, the police took daddy away. The police took mommy. It's like, I hate the police. Off of that one experience, you see how bad the police are. And then the parents that you do lock up, you know, you're just putting their hands behind their back and placing handcuffs on it. You're not covering their mouth. You're not putting tape over their mouth. So they're still able to talk. So they're saying, you see what the police did? You see, you see what mom did? You know what I mean? So it's kind of like the hatred can go to the mom too, where it's like, oh, mom got my dad locked up. I hate my mom. We see that a lot too, but we see the cops as like, oh no, the cops are here. Like, let's not talk to the cops. And another example would be sometimes we're just in the street on a post or whatever, and like a child and the mother comes, and the child, you know, they learn about the cops through school. Like, you know, if you call 911, they're here to help you. So they'll wave at you, right? And then I remember, I'll never forget it. The kid had to be at least 6 years old. And they wave at me. And I'm like, hey, how are you? And the mom's like, don't effing talk to them.
Wow.
You know what I mean? So it's kind of built from that young in their life, like, distrust the police, hate the police. Mm-hmm. They're not here to help.
Yeah. Wow. I know that cities are doing community-based policing. I've always had this idea of, you know, before a police officer gets his badge, his or her badge, that they, and a gun, they go into the community and they do spend time in the community that they'll be policing in, because they'll have such an amplified role in that community. They'll have a lot more power than they did as an individual citizen in that community. And I think that that would also allow them to build community connections with community centers, leaders, religious institutions, etc. Do you think that would help with the trust, at least between officers and the community?
To a certain extent. And I say that because the people that do come out to it, again, like, you can't force the entire neighborhood to come out. Like, it's not going to happen, right? So I believe the people that are willing to come out are just like, hey, let's just give the cops a chance, or let's just see what they have to say, right? And 9 times out of 10, those aren't the people that really need the convincing. You know what I mean? The people that need the convincing, or the people that we need to convince, are the people who refuse to come. Oh, once it says police in it, I'm not going. I'm not going to that. And that's what we're seeing a lot. Like, you'll be surprised of how small those events really are, even though they're promoted for like a month, 2 months, you know?
Yeah, because the trust just isn't there, right?
Exactly. So how do you build trust in the community? My answer would be being in the schools at an early age, being involved in the kids' life from, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, and being consistent about it, not just saying, okay, we're here for sixth grade and that's it, or we're here for kindergarten and that's it. Because I think if you step in at a high school level, it's already like, come on, bro, like, you lost. You know, you got to step in at a kindergarten or first grade level and continue to step in throughout that term.
I have a question for you. I wanted to ask you about adult-based influence. And it's like, to me, what's fascinating about all of this is that, again, if we follow the line of thinking that, you know, a kid grows up, let's say in a broken home, goes to school, let's say it's an underfunded school, public school in an inner city, and they don't see kind of a pathway for them, and they latch on to aspirations of gang members, drug dealers in their community, and they sadly enter into that life. And I say they loosely, because not all children do this, but many do.
Correct.
Why is it that that negative influence is so prominent in an adult, which they already distrust, but the positive, like a community worker, isn't? They're also an adult that they don't trust. Like, there's this quagmire that I can't seem to wrap my head around. Like, both are adults, or at least teenagers, like, you know, 17, 18 year old teenagers, maybe sometimes younger, but they're still much older than this child. And they're engaging in nefarious activity. And the child already distrusts older people in general, but yet trusts this person.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it's odd to me.
So my understanding is basically we're not catering to the audience, right? So, for example, the drug dealer, right? The drug dealer is wearing the hot clothes, the shoes, the sneakers, the car, you know, the jewelry, all that, right? Like, he has a lifestyle that they may want. When they see the police officer, they see the police officer in uniform. So we're not, the cops are not dressed the way that they want to be dressed. Like, they're like, I don't want to wear that uniform, or I don't want to wear those corny clothes or that suit. I want to wear those Jordans, or I want to wear those Nike Air Maxes, and I want that really dope car, not that ugly cop car that's sitting out front with lights and sirens on it. You know what I mean? We're not catering to the audience. Because, you know, if I dressed outside of uniform, like, you'd be like, oh, wow, this is a totally different person. Like, I love jerseys, you know what I mean? And, you know, I like to rock, like, a lot of throwback, you know, Toronto Raptors jerseys, the McGrady, the Vince Carter one. So, you know, like, they know that. These kids know that because they're playing 2K, right? And, like, we're really good at 2K, too. Like, a lot of cops, they play 2K or Call of Duty or whatever. But we don't have events like that, which we should, which I think we should, right? And maybe that way we could learn to connect. Like, hey, man, look, just because we wear this uniform doesn't mean that we're not, we're still somebody outside of this. But the drug dealers, they just look at them like, hey, that's who they are, and that's what I want to be. That's who I want to emulate. They don't know that, like, they think that teachers are teachers 24/7. Like, I used to think that when I was, like, when I saw my teacher in, like, ShopRite, I used to be like, this is weird. You do grocery? Like, what the hell is going on here? You know what I mean? Like, they think, like, it's just, you know what it is? It's like, that's what, they probably look at Lisa, and if they saw Lisa in the mall, they'd probably be like, what is Dr. whatever doing here?
Right. I think, like, one of those misconceptions is, you know, like what Phil said, when I was younger and I went to the doctors, all my doctors were very, very much older and very much wiser. So my assumption of doctors were that you weren't a doctor and you weren't practicing until you were 60, 70, 80, and that wasn't appealing to me. And now when I take care of patients that are my age, I go into the room and they're like, well, you know, thanks for so-and-so nurse. We're going to wait for the doctor. And I'm like, no, I am the doctor. But we have a misconception with our, across the board, with our youth. We have there's some sort of bridge that we need to connect.
And I think the bridge is just mirroring them. And I think that we're so focused on them mirroring us. You know what I mean? And that's like, it's just mind blowing to me. Like, why would a kid want to mirror you? Why don't you mirror them and then show them your fruits of labor? You know what I mean?
Is like, it societal pressure? We need to do and excel so much at our jobs that we lose focus on who our people are, who our youth are, who our demographics are. We're just trying to be the best that we can because we want job security as well, that we lose focus on what there is, maybe.
Yeah, it could be. Like, I think that the disparity between rich and poor is growing dramatically. Like, I mean, here in Toronto, rent is just going out of control. A one bedroom downtown where I live is $2,700 a month on average. And my friends and I always ask ourselves, like, how could you possibly live in the city on minimum wage? Like, you have to be working multiple jobs at least. So, and if that's going to continue to grow, that gap, that pushes people below the poverty line at a very precarious position. It's like, they're not only competing to survive, every adult around them is also competing to survive. So that community worker may not give that kid the same amount of time. And that might be the only adult that that kid interacts with that actually wants to see that child progress, as an example, right?
Right.
So I can see this being like very, very scary for the kid. I want to ask you the same question I asked Lisa, which is, I feel, again, we're just barely scratching the surface, but if there was one thing that municipal, state, federal should focus on when it comes to poverty and crime, what would you say? Would it be very similar to Lisa in, you know, education, breaking down stigma, etc.? Or is it something totally different?
For me, it would be a lot more. I mean, I do agree with that. And I think that that will work. But to add on to it, I think it would be understanding, you know, like understanding them and understanding, like, so I'll give you an example, right? Like why kids get into gangs and knowing the reason, like there's a danger getting into a gang and they all know it. Like everybody knows it. It's not a secret. The problem is that when someone dies in a gang, whether it be the smallest person in the gang or the biggest person in the gang, they are celebrated, right? The memorial, you should see it. The memorial, they shut like two blocks down. It's a show. It's really insane of what goes on here, but they're celebrated like Nelson Mandela or whatever. I think we need to start communicating, like, hey, you can be celebrated too, but in a different way. You know what I mean? Like, I think we need to start taking what they already know, which is like making money and getting like really nice shoes and just taking the violence out of it, or leaving the violence in and kind of just being like, hey man, you could commit these, you know, acts of violence, but this is what will eventually end up happening to you. And the same thing with healthcare, right? Like, you could continue to like not go to like your doctor's appointments or not take your medicine or all these other things and not eat right, and this is what will happen to you. And just kind of like relate to them. I think that we fall short in relating to the youth. And I think the youth is extremely, the most important audience that we have. Like, forget about the adults, forget about all that. Like, the youth, it's all about the youth. And the reason being is those people, whether we want to believe it or not, are our future leaders, are the future doctors, are the future politicians. And I think that instead of like funding people's pockets and just giving them money and doing this and doing that, if we could just empower our youth and tell them, hey, listen, you matter. You're important. Your ideas can be something one day. We'll be in a better place.
Yeah, I like that. I think, you know, on the extreme side, I was listening to, you know, Ben Shapiro, who's a very prominent political voice. He made this very extreme argument about Baltimore and inner city youth crime and violent crime. And his argument, if I could summarize it, was basically build a massive wall around low-income communities in Baltimore, get all the drug dealers and violent criminals, criminals writ large, send them on a bus, send them completely out of there, off to a jail far, far away. So that way you're left in the community with people who actually want to be in the community and build it up. That way it would attract development and private investment. Because the biggest thing is that once a community is violent, businesses leave in like dramatic numbers because, you know, they're not going to risk their business reputation. It seems like such an extreme opinion, but at the same time, it's like, I understand the line of thinking and I understand the logic.
Right. Like, if you were to really think about it, especially with the business idea and going back to Lisa, like, if you, there's an infamous strip in this area. I won't say the name, but it's kind of like, we'll call it Main Street. And if you look at Main Street, there was a lot of businesses there, like back in the day, in like the 70s and 80s. And people tell me all the time, like, this was the place to shop. But if you look at it now, it's a lot of closed down businesses. And the only thing that are there, that's there is Chinese restaurants.
Abandoned churches.
Abandoned churches and bodegas, which all sell like...
unnutritious.
Or like Doritos.
Right. They promote food deserts.
Like you'll never see a Whole Foods here or like a ShopRite or like... There's no like chain type of like grocery stores here. There's one.
Right. But I think the idea is that, contrary to that notion, is that we are having investors and we are having businesses come back in. But we're having them come back in on such a grand scale that it is ultimately pushing the low income residents.
Gentrification. Right. That gentrification is happening in this area.
And it's pushing these people out. And it's pushing them away. And either what it's doing is it's forcing these people to make these really difficult choices. And it creates this cycle. Now the rent is going up. So one of the things that we have here is Section 8. And Section 8 is a government partially subsidized rent fund for low-income families. And it creates a cycle where a family, which it can be a single-parent household, so let's say mother and children, if she's making a certain amount of income, then she does not qualify for Section 8. But it creates a cycle where mom can say, hey, I have 2, 3, 4, and 5 children, why should I go find a full-time job? Why not work part-time and have Section 8 subsidize the rest of my rent? And it creates this really comfortable cycle of not wanting to be uncomfortable and grow out of that and strive for better. And I think it, what it does it can be a detriment to the society, where it keeps people where they are, or it keeps them in check and doesn't allow people to grow and progress. And then we have these big developments that are coming in and then just creating this atmosphere where things are unobtainable, where we will have a Whole Foods in an area where families cannot afford food from Whole Foods.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. I love that. I love that. And I feel like that should be the topic for our next conversation is investment in these areas, because I think that's very important.
Oh, there's going to be a part two?
I mean, we've probably part 8, 9, and 10 at this point.
Let's do it, man. I'll put it.
All right, let's try for change.
Yeah, we barely scratched the surface today on poverty and healthcare and poverty and crime. But for those that don't necessarily see those linkages, I'm hoping that these two conversations showcase them a little bit more clearly. It's one thing to read stats, it's another thing to talk to people who are in the field. So thank you so much for coming on, talking about your own experiences. I'm hoping that people take something away. I'm hoping both of you are taking something away from this, because I really enjoyed our conversation together.
Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity, bro. Appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of the Open Minds podcast. I'm your host, Christopher Balkrin. And reminder, you can find me at www.openmindspodcast.com, on Instagram at Open Minds Pod, or on TikTok at Open Minds Podcast. Feel free to leave a comment, like, or follow. Send me a message. Let me know what you think of this episode, and I will definitely catch you in the next one.